Reply. Pavlofatidis on a Thursday night with Small Business. Mwanda Tsoliwe from Centurion, and he tweeted, I'm going to pretend to be Mwanda.
Are you going to be him?
I'm feeling butch. Hey, Pavlo, maybe you've covered this. Let's assume you've done all the hard yards. Getting into retail shops remains one of the hardest things to do. What metrics do retailers use? And what can a budding business with intentions to get into retail do right in the beginning? Do we know what Mwanda does?
We don't know, but I'm assuming that he has a budding business and he wants to get into retail.
So does he want to open his own shop or does he want to supply to retail?
Well, if you've got a good product, you know, both options are open to you. So it wasn't very clear to me, but I'm guessing he wants to get into retail. He's got a product. He wants to supply retail. Yeah. And he's met that fateful group called the buyers and planners.
Are they scary?
Oh, they are terrifying. I've dealt with them extensively. And honestly, one of the businesses that I built and sold, thank heavens it got sold because... Wow, dealing with buyers and planners is a different story in its own right. I mean,
their purpose is to source the best possible product they can for their retail business at the best possible price, because the less they can pay you for it, the more margin they can make when they put it on the shelf.
Yeah, you know, another way of looking at their purpose is to maximize the return on revenue per square centimeter of shelf space. And you are just simply going to be the meat in the flesh or the meat in the sandwich around this. So when they look to buy your product, they're looking to see that A, you can deliver, that B, you can forecast effectively, that C, you will carry stock. Because what happens is if they promote the product, if they have the product on their shelves and you can't supply, they lose and they lose their margin, they lose their targets, they get put into a lot of pain. So that comes back to you. You then have to offer rebates. You have to support promotion. You've got to take care of merchandising.
Okay, now you're using words that you know the meaning of. Mm. I think I know the meaning of. So let's go back to the term of rebate. So now I've got a thing that costs 100 rand, and I would like you to sell it on your shelves. So I come to you and I say, Pablo, you are the supermarket owner. I'd like you to sell my thing, my very nice pie. For 100 rand. And you say, sure, I can sell your pie. I can probably sell it for 106 rand or 103 rand. I'm going to make a 3% margin because I'm a supermarketer. But actually, I need to make a bigger margin than that. So I need you to sell me your pie for less money. I need you to give me a discount. Is that what a rebate is?
No, not really.
Okay.
No, not really. You know, the buying process works quite differently, Bruce. So the first thing is that the planner looks and sees what the trends are of the category of your product. And you've got four types of products that you can supply into retail. You can either supply an absolute necessity, so like super, super cheap one-ply toilet paper that doesn't have perforated tears in it or anything like that. It's the cheapest of the cheapest that possibly can exist. And when you're playing in the necessity market, it is, honestly, unless you're supplying to a retailer that is far away from anything and everyone, it really is a very, very difficult business to build, exceptionally difficult, because the only way to get proper pricing right there is with massive, but massive volumes. And that really is the domain of very big established manufacturers. The next option is if you're supplying a commodity. So commodity isn't a necessity. Let's say commodity could be peanut butter. You don't have to have it, but most people would like it. It's fairly widely available. So what sets yours apart from anyone else's? And unless you actually have one of the big brands, like a Black Cat or I don't know what the brands are anymore, in peanut butter. But
is this still Yum Yum?
I think Yum Yum's another big brand.
It's still there.
But there are one or two big brands that really dominate the space. The buyer or the planner looks at you and says, well, we need some fighter brands from a price point perspective. We're going to take your product, but we're going to put it in the worst part or the worst located part of the shelf. It's hard to play in that game. It's hard to win in that game, especially if you only have one product. If you have a bundle of, let's call it necessity and commodity products, you can negotiate a bit more firmly with the retailer. Then you have an exclusive product, and that's quite interesting. And that's when it starts getting interesting in retail. Because if you're the only person with the rights or the ability to produce a product, and that retailer sees value in the product in that it serves the kinds of customers that they are negotiating with, that they have coming to their stores on a frequent basis, and it really marries and meets the needs of those kinds of consumers, then you can start to negotiate with a bit more intelligence and a bit more leverage. But you need to be sure that that, let's call it exclusive product, doesn't have too many substitutes either. And a substitute is something that could be just as good, just as fine, or a complete alternative that will make that will satisfy my needs as a consumer as opposed to your exclusive product. Then you've got the luxury items, and the luxury items are very hard to retail successfully in this country for the simple reason that there's an extremely thin, narrow market, and that market mostly buys these products abroad where they can, you know, avoid all the duties and they can get in-season products that are more relevant in any event.
Okay.
And in fact, they're mostly cheap overseas than they are over here in any event.
This is true. Okay.
So depending on what product it is, it's going to determine what strategy you follow.
All right. So you manage to get in, and you then get this thing called a rebate.
Mm.
And you've got to pay. You've got to now give this rebate, and in order to get your product on the shelf. So now you are, as the supplier, immediately on the back foot. So how do you deal with it?
Well, what you need to realize is, so depending on which product it is, and let's say that the most viable product to get into a retailer with is going to be probably an exclusive product of some sort. You then have to convince the planner to give you decent shelf space. Now, here's the thing. When planners prepare to put products into their stores, what they look for are products that will reach right across their national footprint. Because if they're going to run a promotion on it, it's a national promotion. So that immediately now means, Bruce, you've got to get stock on hand. You've got to organize distribution to either their distribution centers or to their stores. And you have to get a merchandiser to place it on the shelf. So they don't place it on the shelf. You need to have a merchandiser that you pay to place it on the shelf. And you're paying anywhere between 17 and 12, maybe 15%, depending on what the product is, to have the product picked up from your store, distributed around the country, placed on the shelf in an orderly fashion that meets the standards and requirements specified by the retailer. You then have to fight for the right location on the shelf. And it makes an enormous difference because the big brands are normally placed in the middle. The next brands that the retailers try and offload onto consumers are the retail-owned brands, what they call the white label brands.
Yeah.
And then yours might sit on either side of that, typically at the bottom, just so, well, if the white label brand and the big brand don't work, you know, maybe you might pick up the lesser known brand, which is probably yours.
I don't know how conscious we all are of the process of buying, but when you buy and you've got a favorite brand, so you might have a favorite brand of tomato sauce, and you go in and you search for that particular brand of tomato sauce, you don't see
nothing else.
The five other bottles, unless there's something particularly compelling, you've got to really. You're not making this a very attractive proposition at all.
No, it's not. So then the way to get around that is if you're not getting pull through from the shelf, because a retailer is expecting the product to fall off the shelf into the basket, as I was once told by probably one of the most skilled buyers in this country that works for, he works in amongst the Massmart group, exceptionally skilled. He says the product must fall off the shelf into the basket. That's it. That's what I look to assess. Now, it's hard to make that happen if you are not a well-known brand.
Absolutely.
So then what you would be expected to do is run promotions in store. And that's typically where you might get a few students to come and set up a little table, dress out in a uniform, and convince you to either taste the product or try the product or hold the product or switch the product on or switch it off or whatever the case is. Because if you can do that, the product then stands out and you can have someone try and actively sell it. That needs to be paid for as well. The retailer then also says to you, so listen, Bruce, I like your product. I think we're going to give it a go. We're going to give it a punt. We're going to create a whole series of broadsheets. These broadsheets go out with all the local newspapers. You know, the Caxton papers that go out.
The lock and drops, yes.
The lock and drops. They go out everywhere. But, hey, listen, you've got to pay for your place and space in that. And in paying for your place and space in that, we need you to pay a contribution to it. Then it goes out. The next thing they then say is, listen, the rate of moving the product off the shelf is not happening at the rate that you forecast and that we expected. So we have got too much of your stock on hand. We need you to take that back. Plus, there are a whole lot of articles that were brought back by customers. We don't question why they return them. You need to come and collect them. That happens at a cost too. So they might turn around and say, It's 100 Rand. We're selling it for 106. But the costs that stack up behind that are substantial, and it can add an extra 30 to 40 Rand on the 6 Rand that you have just thought would be the margin that the retailer makes.
Raymond Ackerman once told me a fabulous story about how in the early days of Pick and Pay, he would go and play golf with his chicken supplier, for example, and he learned to know his chicken supplier really well, one particular one, and he could tell by the quality of the guy's golf game as to whether he could squeeze him for an extra few cents. If the guy was having a good golf game, he'd squeeze him for an extra few cents on the kilogram in terms of the price that he would pay for his chickens. And it was a strategy that he worked. So these guys, I mean, Raymond Ackerman is the master at this sort of stuff. And I think he taught generations of retailers on how to do the buying. He did the buying himself, you know, in the early days of Pick and Pay. They will find ways to ensure that they get the best possible price advantage out of you as the supplier, which they then say we will pass on to the customer. But in that process also, they expand their own margins. They're in business, of course, and that's why they do it. But it becomes very hard for small suppliers into retail to make a go of it. Lots of people do, and lots of people become very successful. Lots of people become quite wealthy as a result of getting in. Everybody who's got a product wants to get into the supply chains of the retailers, but you've got to know how to do it. You've got to know what the pitfalls are, and that's what Pablo is doing this evening. So where do we go from here? You've told us how horrible it is and how difficult it is and how difficult it is and how much money you've got to pay to get access. What's next? Let's assume we're prepared to do this.
Are we going to do it?
We're doing it. No, we're tough. Okay. We're stupid. I'm not sure.
All right. So look, we can approach this from two ways. I can give you like 5 steps, or I can talk about 3 retailers that have done it well and what made them special, what made them succeed. And that might be a better way of doing it,
okay,
Bruce.
Do it that way.
Because one of my favorite retailers in this entire country is the Cape Union Mart Group. They've got Cape Union Mart, they've got Poetry, they've got Olkaki and Tredham Miller. Those are the retail brands I'm familiar with. Every time I walk into that store, I get exactly what I expected and thought I would get. So I'm never disappointed. The expectation that they've managed to create in my mind around how they've positioned these 4 brands has remained absolutely consistent. Secondly, the ability to work with people on the floor. You know, it's remarkable. It's the only store I walk into where I'm approached directly by a retail assistant. And when I do challenge the retail assistant on the products, they've got knowledge behind them. And normally I see the same people there consistently the same time,
you know,
all the time.
You know, you are of a particular demographic. You are of an age that the only place buy that fit and are comfortable, that you're comfortable to wear, is in Cape Union Mart.
And Olkaki.
And Olkaki.
And Fred and Miller.
You are the target market.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So there's a resonance in that. And what I think has made them successful is that they've vertically integrated their business. So for example, what that means is they own a lot of the brands that they sell as their primary product in their store. So they've got that brand, I think it's called K-Way. I'm not sure what it is, but
it's the K-Way.
Is it the K-Way?
Mr. Kravitz.
Yes.
The man who started it, he said, there's only one way, and that's the K-Way. He's told us all about it.
Oh, yes. Wonderful. It's a wonderful story. But now it gives you full control over the product. It gives you control over the seasons. It gives you control over the ranges, the colors. You can really resonate quite nicely with where you believe your market, like, who you understand quite well, evidently, is moving and going. So that's one good example of, let's call it, exclusive retailers owning their own stores, having built up momentum and mass over 3 generations now, generations to get there, and have a meaningful place in the retail landscape of South Africa. I think any big mall that doesn't have any one of their stores is going to suffer and lose out. You know, the malls will approach them, in fact, to actually locate in their stores.
They've become. I mean, I found a tent that my father-in-law bought 20 years ago. It was a K-Way tent, and the thing still is robust and works. I mean, they've created their own niche. I mean, but it's very hard for somebody who's starting out and trying to get into retail and trying to break into retail now to even envisage 20 years from now. They can't do it. They are just busy surviving now.
And that's the length of the game.
Yeah.
So if you have a product right now, what are you going to do with it? The first thing is, make sure it's an exclusive product. Don't go for necessities. Don't go for commodities, because you'll never win at that game. And let's use a good example. So let's say you created a range, and I've worked with a business that has done this. They created a range of fashionable, safe biker wear. So it looks good, but it also is safe. and it has breathing chambers, and it's got Teflon coating in it. So if you fall off the motorbike, you don't get burnt and damaged, etc., etc., etc. If that is the kind of product you have, the first thing before you bring it in or before you manufacture it is go and join the community of people that will typically buy it. So buy a motorbike, go on motorbike rides, do the Hearties run, go on bike tours, spend time in the community and see what people buy, understand what they buy, understand why they buy what they buy, see what they like about what they buy, understand what people take back and what kind of service they get for it. Because Bruce, if you look at a product, you're missing the entire game of retail. Yeah. You've got to look at who you serve first and what problems you solve for them. Because if you understand where those individuals shop, what they look for when they buy a product, how they're thinking and how their mind works around buying the product, you're starting then to make a good decision whether this bike product you've identified that you want to make or you're importing has any validity. Once you've got that right, bring in your first batch. And when you bring it in, offer it to the community, show it to people, get their opinions, but don't believe anything they say. Because if you're a nice guy, people are always going to support it and say, "Oh, Bruce, yeah, for sure, I'd love it. You know, hey, let me know when it comes in. I'll be the first to buy." You have to ask questions beyond the obvious, let's call it applause and platitudes that people offer you. You have to truly, truly understand why they want to buy it and how their decision around buying it would operate.
Would you dissuade somebody with big, bold ambitions to get into retail? Because
yes, absolutely.
But there are some people who crack it. There are some people who become preferred suppliers, and there are some people who make a very good living out of getting their product into retail.
I would dissuade anyone getting into retail. In South Africa, I would dissuade literally anyone getting into retail. You know, if you want to establish your own store, try and do a deal with a mall. Try and do a deal with a landlord in a mall. You know, you will be paying between 3 to 6 months ahead of time. They will specify the shop fit out at your cost. You will be told what trading hours to operate on, so you'll have to have two shifts. The churn in retail staff in this country is beyond even comprehensible. And on top of it, you're going to be paying anywhere between 8 to 10 to 12% annual rental increases, plus a share of your revenues, when inflation's running at around 4.5% and the economy's growing at less than 1%. No, I think it's suicidal.
On that joyful note, you've been warned, Mwanda. If you don't want the answers, don't ask the questions. But Mwanda, I hope that helps you. Pablo's given guidance on how to do it. He just doesn't recommend that you do.